for coming and being brave enough to tackle this topic. I should say right away that in the field of research on sexual harassment and assault, the word sexual violence is an umbrella term, and it includes sexual assault, sexual harassment, and related behaviors. And I'll be telling you about a journey I took as a researcher that started more than 25 years ago and led me to have some thoughts about what institutions can do to address these issues. So I'm going to give you five brief chapters in this presentation. I'm going to start with some older work on betrayal trauma theory and betrayal blindness, then tell you about newer work on what I call institutional betrayal, give you a little bit of data from some studies we've done now in the last 5 years on sexual violence on campus, talk about the very important issue of disclosure, what happens when people do or do not report what happened to them, and one particular kind of very bad response that I call DARVO, and then end with a discussion of institutional courage, which is more or less my proposed antidote for institutional betrayal. So starting with this much now older work, I'm going to take you back to 1992 and describe to you something that I was learning about and personally touched by and could not account for as at that point in my career a memory psychologist. So at that point in 1992, I was working, or the late 80s, working as a professor studying memory and perception. And there were cases such as this. Frank Fitzpatrick began remembering having been sexually molested by a parish priest at age 12. Mr. Fitzpatrick's retrieval of the repressed memories began, he said, when I was feeling a great mental pain. Mr. Fitzpatrick slowly realized that the mental pain was due to a betrayal of some kind and remembered the sound of heavy breathing. Then I realized I'd been sexually abused by someone I love, said Mr. Fitzpatrick. But it was not until 2 weeks later that he suddenly remembered the priest, the Reverend James R. Porter. This was a very famous case in the early 1990s. In this case, Porter actually ended up confessing to this abuse. Many, many victims came forward. But it was Frank Fitzpatrick who got the whole thing going 30 years after the fact by remembering something he'd forgotten. And that memory issue was clearly an enormous intellectual puzzle at the time. So I started to develop a theory that I came to call betrayal trauma theory. And the initial research questions to related questions were why and how would individuals remain unaware of or forget traumas they'd experienced? And why are some traumas forgotten and not others? And the answer I proposed addressed both how questions and why questions. The cognitive mechanisms being the how questions, the why questions really more an issue of almost like an evolutionary question. Like, why in the world would we be behaving this way? I'm not going to tell you about the answers that we came up with for the how questions, because they were ultimately actually kind of boring, in the sense that humans are learning machines, we're memory machines, we have a lot of ways that we can remember, a lot of ways we can forget, and we do it all the time. And the only thing really different here was it was episodes being forgotten, and important episodes. But it was, but there was a ton of research, there continues to be, to answer the how question. The why question struck me as a deeper and more important question. And the proposal I came up with considers two things about us as human beings. One is that we are tremendously sensitive to betrayal. If you think about our literature, our art, our politics, they often focus on betrayal. And betrayal comes from any time we trust somebody and they violate that trust. As a very social species, we engage in relationships constantly that have a social contract. Sometimes it's very formal, like a marriage vow, or buying an expensive product and signing a house. But often these contracts are implicit. If you're my friend, you're not going to violate my secrets. And every time we have a contract, we are at risk of being cheated on. Being cheated on, these betrayals are very costly to us. We've given a resource and we've not gotten something back. So it is completely logical that we would be sensitive to this so as to protect ourselves from future betrayal. And when we're empowered, the response to cheating is to be active. We either confront or withdraw. It's kind of like you've probably heard of fight or flight. Metaphorically, it's like that. It's what we do to protect ourselves. So you say to somebody, you're dating who you've just found out has not been faithful to you, you say, I'm not going to see you anymore, or you insist that that person never do that again and make right. And you can think of lots of examples in which this has happened. And it happens to everybody. Everybody gets betrayed. Everybody betrays other people. And most of the time when empowered, we do something to protect ourselves. There's something else about us, and we've got a model of this in the room right now, so it's perfect, which is that we are tremendously dependent upon others. And this dependence is actually true throughout the lifespan, but it is most obvious in infancy. Human infants are born ridiculously premature in the biological sense. Human infants can't walk. Think of other mammals. They get up and walk. They can't do anything to protect themselves at all. They utterly and completely depend on caregiving to stay alive for like 5 minutes. The caregiving is very, very expensive. It's an enormous amount of work to take care of a human infant. And then, of course, it extends over a long period of childhood involving additional resource giving. It's an asymmetric relationship in one sense because resources are moving in one direction, but it's a reciprocal relationship in another sense, which is that we have an evolved system called the attachment system that other animals have as well. Humans have a very, very pronounced attachment system. The attachment system is hardwired, and it has some built-in reinforcers. The caregiver and the baby both have attachment systems. The caregiver is crazily reinforced by certain baby behaviors. Big eyes, eye fixation, the little cooing sounds, the smile. If a baby cannot do those things, it's really hard for a caregiver to continue to expend this crazy amount of resource giving, even when they're motivated, even consciously motivated. It's such a primal reinforcement system. But the way we experience this is through the emotion of love, because the best way to get that caregiving is to love the caregiver. And love is an approach behavior. It's an engage, an approach behavior. And you could say that it's a kind of job that the dependent creature, the baby in this case, has to love and be lovable. Throughout the lifespan, this dependence is there. But we live in a world where we like to revere independence and have an illusion we're independent. But if you think about it, you're all dependent on probably other people, and if not other people, on the infrastructure. You're dependent on your government, your employer. Dependency is all over the place. So what happens when the caregiver is the betrayer? And here the core idea of betrayal trauma theory is that you have a very profound conflict of interest here, and that attachment trumps betrayal detection. Well, betrayal detection's good when you're empowered. It's more important to protect necessary relationships. If you're not empowered, confrontation and withdrawal are very dangerous responses. And so there's a built-in safety mechanism, which is suppress betrayal if it's coming from somebody you're highly dependent upon. Awareness of betrayal will get you into trouble. It will motivate behaviors that will simply make your situation worse. We call this betrayal blindness. And the idea here is that it is an adaptive response to a difficult situation. And one I will suggest we all are in at certain times in our life. We all have people we depend on or systems we depend on that in one way or another betray us. And the survival problem we have is, do we rock the boat and lose what's working, but then live with the problem? Or do we confront the problem, but maybe lose what's working? Betrayal trauma theory suggests that there are really two dimensions of events, and this is about events, that are potentially harmful to us and that comprise trauma. One is the one you've probably thought about and heard about, which is traumas are scary. They're fear-inducing. That often is associated with life threat. Automobile accidents, natural disasters, violent attacks are terrifying, and they're traumatic. Betrayal trauma theory emphasizes a separate, independent dimension of events, which is social betrayal. And you can have any combination here of high or low social betrayal and high or low terror. And the theory is that there's going to be the potential for long-lasting effects in any of the three quadrants on this graph where you've got one of these dimensions in high mode. Notice that you can have an event that starts out low betrayal, like a hurricane, that can turn into a high betrayal event by social response. So it's not just what happens at the moment, it's what happens afterwards as well. So when Hurricane Katrina hit New Orleans, it turned into a betrayal event for a lot of people due to the government's failure to respond appropriately. We saw it more recently in the United States with other hurricanes, the difference in how the government responded to hurricanes hitting the mainland versus Puerto Rico. Betrayal trauma theory makes predictions, and one prediction is that memory is going to be impacted specifically by this betrayal dimension. So we've been testing this in various ways. I'll just tell you about one data set. A specific prediction is that childhood abuse perpetrated by a caregiver will lead to more forgetting than will abuse perpetrated by a non-caregiver. And in one study, what we did was we measured in undergraduate students their childhood abuse history, and those students who had some exposure to childhood abuse, we found out about the relationship they had with the perpetrator and also their memory for that experience over time. And memory impairment refers to forgetting, it's essentially in forgetting. And what we see is that abuse perpetrated by a caretaker leads to more forgetting than abuse perpetrated by a non-caretaker. This is exceedingly messy research to do. It's not experimental. The real world, it comes with co-varying factors, and the the tool we have to deal with that is statistical analysis, where we try to control for variables that are co-varying with the variable of interest. To date, those analyses suggest that the caretaker variable is, in fact, accounting for most of the variance. As the time has gone on, and this research started in the mid-90s, we have accumulated evidence that betrayal blindness is quite pervasive. It's not just victims. Witnesses can exhibit betrayal blindness. So if you're in a workplace and your coworker's being mistreated, but you're not, you may still not see that betrayal, even though it's there to be seen, because it's dangerous for you to see that betrayal. And perpetrators can also forget, in some sense, be unaware of their own betrayals. And we believe it's fundamentally to preserve relationships upon which people depend. Importantly, this is really different than what was the only sort of explanation out there, which is that somehow we would forget or be unaware just because it's painful. First of all, that's a terrible argument from an evolutionary perspective, because what's painful we should remember and be very aware of. But also it's empirically wrong, because you can think of examples of exceedingly painful events that have very low forgetting rates. And an example is the loss of a child. About a peak in pain, very not forgotten. So it goes back to that question of, can we predict which traumas are going to be forgotten and which ones will not? As we continued to do research, we began to expand our exploration and begin to look at other responses to traumatic exposure and ask the question, what part of those responses can be ascribed to the betrayal element? And I'm now going to just summarize over 20 years of empirical work and say a lot. A lot of traditionally known trauma responses are heightened by betrayal. And in all this research, we're always trying to control for the amount of terror or fear, so in a statistical sense. So we see symptoms of depression, anxiety, shame, physical illness, hallucinations, and even problematic substance abuse being at higher rates for people exposed to high betrayal trauma as compared to people exposed to traumas without that high betrayal element. One of the the puzzles that we had was that we were seeing some indication that there were some gender effects going on. And we had, this was a puzzle because a lot of research has suggested that, at least in North American samples, men and women are exposed to about equal rates of trauma overall. And yet, it seemed like maybe there was something going on with betrayal trauma and gender. And in a study that I did with Luke Goldberg, looking at a large, very large sample of homeowners ranging in age from about 20 to 80 years old, we were actually developing a measure to get at betrayal trauma exposure. And in our measure, we were assessing exposure to trauma that varied in how much betrayal was inherent in the trauma. But we had a lot of information about gender differences. And what we saw was that of our 24 possible comparisons we could make, 12 were wildly statistically significant gender effects. But you can see by the color coding that the direction depended very much on the item category. So all of the blue boxes are cases where men are reporting more of a particular kind of exposure, and the violet where women are reporting more. And these are statistical probability levels, so the more stars, the more unlikely this would have been due to chance. And what we see when we organize these by the degree of betrayal is a really profound effect, such that when men report more of the trauma, it's always a low betrayal item, like a natural disaster, an accident, medium, which is attacks, physical attacks, but from somebody not close or known to the victim. And when women report more, it's always high betrayal or some medium betrayal. And we have two empty cells there. This is a striking gender effect. Another way to look at it is when we look at it, what's the probability people are exposed to at least one event we were categorizing as either high or low, and divided by gender. And you see two things popping out here. One is trauma rates are high. Now, on average, these people were in their mid-50s, and that's a lot of time to be, you know, in the world to get exposed to a trauma. But we see that our lowest data point was men for high betrayal, and there's still 30% of our men have been exposed to high betrayal. On the other hand, while that's true, we also have this profoundly significant crossover interaction going on, such that a way to think about this, and you can see the same pattern when you look at just, say, physical assault, is that a woman walking down the street is actually statistically safer than a man walking down the street, because men are more likely to be attacked by strangers. A woman in her home is at much greater risk because women are more likely to be attacked by somebody they are highly connected with. And it's true for boys and girls as well as men and women. So, summary of 20 plus years is betrayal trauma is really toxic in a lot of ways, and it's gendered. I'm going to move now to institutional betrayal. This is a newer research domain for us, although I always was kind of interested in the concept, because one of the high betrayal events that interested me was the Holocaust and any other kind of genocide situation, where you've got a government ordering the murder of its own citizen. You can hardly think of something with more betrayal than that. And that is a kind of institutional betrayal. But we didn't look at it systematically until about 10 years ago, when a remarkable graduate student came into my lab and said, "We are going to figure out how to measure this," and we did. So our first study was looking at the question in an educational context. And the question was, can betrayal trauma occur in response to institutional behaviors? When institutions behave in a way, can humans react as if a person treated them that way? And we define betrayal, institutional betrayal, very broadly as institutions harming those dependent on the institution. But importantly, including the failure to prevent or respond supportively to wrongdoings within the institution when there's a reasonable expectation of protection. And part of our focus here was motivated, this research started in 2010, by what was really getting in the news at that time, which is military sexual trauma, where people were saying, and this was in the United States, I joined the Army, the Navy, whatever, in order to serve my country. But soon after I joined, I was sexually assaulted. And that was horrible. And when I reported it, that was even worse. It was even worse how I was treated by the military than the rapist was. That's a pretty strong statement. And in that case, there's a failure in some sense to protect or respond supportively. So we asked the question, could we measure this? And our very first study was very simple. We used a survey methodology, a college student sample. We measured three constructs: sexual assault experiences, we used an established measure, trauma symptoms, we used an established measure, and then we came up with a new measure for institutional betrayal. And initially what we did was we made a simple checklist. Now this is a good time to tell you that in measuring any kind of exposure to unwanted events that are so stigmatized as sexual assault or betrayal, it's really important not to use words that are big and scary, like words I'm using right now. So when we are talking, when we do a survey, we use behaviorally defined measures and items. We don't ask, were you raped? We ask, did somebody insert something into your vagina or anus without your consent? It's still strong language, but many more people are willing to and able to identify a behavior they experienced than accept a great big label. So when I say people have experienced institutional betrayal, I'm not saying they labeled it that way. I'm saying we have defined it as a construct and measured it in terms of behaviors they may have experienced. If somebody had been exposed to sexual violence, then the question would pop up whether the institution, and it was in an institutional context, whether the institution had shown certain kinds of reactions. Everything from not taking proactive steps to prevent this type of experience all the way to punishing you in some way. What did we find? This study was published in 2013, and we found high rates of lifetime sexual assault in our college sample. That's not news. A lot of researchers have been documenting this since at least the mid-80s. We found trauma symptoms were related to sexual assault, not news. Lots of researchers have documented this. What was new was that 40% of those reporting sexual assault also did indicate some amount of institutional betrayal. And importantly, trauma symptoms were related to institutional betrayal. We have seen a pattern emerge in study after study about what that looks like. And it's captured here. What we see is that institutional betrayal serves as kind of like an added harm. So sexual assault is measured by the number of experiences that a person has been exposed to. So the higher the number, the more sexual assault. And we have one symptom here, anxiety, but we see a similar pattern with other symptoms. Sexual assault is associated with that symptom, but the relationship is much stronger. The slope is greater when institutional betrayal is also present. So this, to me, indicates that the institutions, what they're doing or failing to do, is itself potentially harmful to people. And there's at least two ways this is true. One is if institutions are failing to prevent these behaviors, there are going to be more behaviors. But this is something else. This is when the institution is responding poorly or failing to prevent, there's actually an additional psychological burden for people. It turns out there's also a physical burden. So physical health is also impacted. Again, controlling for exposure to the interpersonal, we see more pain and sleep difficulties and using of medical facilities. Sometimes this catches the attention of university administrators if other things don't. We also see indication of betrayal blindness in response to institutional betrayal. The word dissociation and dissociative symptoms refers to a cluster of failures to integrate reality. So it can be spacing out, forgetting. And dissociation is well known to be associated with trauma exposure. What we find is that when somebody's been exposed to institutional betrayal and then they stay in the institution, they have higher rates of dissociative symptoms. We don't know the order in which this occurred, but it is consistent with betrayal blindness, that if you're able to block out that behavior, you're more able to stay in that institution. Another finding from a different lab that was using US military veterans who had been all of them had been exposed to military sexual trauma. And the researchers measured the exposure to institutional betrayal and found that those military sexual trauma survivors who'd experienced institutional betrayal had higher rates of PTSD, depression, and I think really alarmingly higher rates of attempted suicide. We've not measured this ourselves in our lab, but I would expect we'd probably see that with college students as well. We also have indication that institutional betrayal reinforces inequality along other dimensions. So we see those with less status appear to have more exposure to both to higher rates of victimization, but then once they are in the category of a victimized person, higher rates of institutional betrayal in response to their victimization. Institutional betrayal also is costly to institutions. So we've measured disengagement from the system, illness, absenteeism, turnover, and we have reason to believe this is going to lead to loss of potential workforce and talent. And I strongly suspect a kind of internal rot or corruption and eventually collapse of institutions when this is not dealt with. Are there reputational costs? It really depends on the society and the social context. Right now, there are some reputational costs. It isn't always that way. But what's interesting is, you know, we can get to in discussion why do institutions behave the way they do? But one factor surely is short-term reputation protection. But it may be that it doesn't even work for that, depending on that on the outside context. A tip, and I'll come back to this near the end, is I think it's really important to regularly measure institutional betrayal through carefully done anonymous surveys, not just victimization, but people's experience with the institutional behavior. Okay, lessons from sexual violence on campus. So for years and years, I was in my lab really focusing primarily, actually, on child abuse and its impact and looking at betrayal. And the reason for child abuse is it really profoundly affects people, what happens to them in childhood. And it sets them up for a whole host of downstream experiences, including more victimization. So people who are abused as children in a high betrayal context are more likely to find themselves as college students, for example, exposed to more abuse and high betrayal experiences, presumably because some of their ways of coping put them at higher risk later on. For instance, blocking out information. So in order to study child abuse, I was often measuring college sexual assault kind of as an outcome variable. When the discussion in the United States turned very strongly to college sexual assault, I perked up and got interested in helping respond to the effort to address this problem. We know that sexual assault and harassment on campus, first of all, it's usually a betrayal trauma in that it's most likely perpetrated by somebody the victim knows and often depends on in some way. The victimization risk is highly associated with gender and other aspects of social inequality. It's associated with numerous negative outcomes, and it's compounded by institutional betrayal. Seems important thing to do something about. As I mentioned, there was this really profound growing awareness of campus sexual trauma. You know, it's interesting because some people think like sexual violence only came on the scene with Me Too. And clearly there was some jump in awareness with Me Too, but it didn't come out of nowhere. This awareness has been growing and growing. There were church abuse things coming to light, the Boston Globe, a huge expose in the year 2000, military sexual trauma. The campus sexual assault movement was a really strong grassroots movement that was covered in almost every major magazine in the United States in the years 2013 and 2014. And amazingly, the US White House created a task force to address this problem. I mean, I don't think that any American administration had picked sexual violence as a topic deserving that kind of attention. Certainly not the current one. Meanwhile, at the University of Oregon, where I have been a professor for a very long time, a crisis erupted in the year 2014, in May of 2014. And the crisis was around one particular allegation of rape involving athletes, both the victim and the alleged perpetrators. And there were many questions about how the university administration had responded. And a lot of these questions arose from the simple fact that the rape actually had been reported to police in March, and it didn't come to light until May. And in the meantime, the alleged perpetrators, who were members of the basketball team, had been allowed to play in the national championship. And so it was not a difficult conclusion to come to that the university had prioritized reputation and athletics at the expense of the safety of students on campus. And there were protests, and it was quite tumultuous. And the administration, knowing the work I did, asked me if I would come to a meeting and help them respond, and I did. And then one of the things I suggested was an anonymous survey. And at the time, the U.S. task force had also said this was a really crucial first step. I had actually prepared an anonymous survey in response to a request from a U.S. senator, so I had it sitting on my desk. And I said, I can run it, collect the information this summer, we'll be ready in the fall to start making good policy. The administration said, yes, yes, that's a great plan. Can we see the survey? I gave them the survey. A week later, they're like, I don't think we're going to do this. And at the time, when they first asked me for help and I said I could do this, I said, you know, normally this is somewhat expensive. There's administration costs. We have to pay people for their participation. But look, I can run it through my lab. I just need the money to pay participants. They said, how much? I said, let's see, $30 a person, 1,000 people represent a sample, $30,000. They said, fine. But when they said, no, we're not going to do this, they also said, no, we're not going to spend $30,000 on this. So I decided, actually, we really needed it. And so I found $30,000 a different way and ran the survey in my lab, and I just stayed up all summer. And we just made it happen, and we got results. And it really actually changed things, I think, at the university. When the results got presented, the university had to own them because I was serving on the faculty senate. I presented them as a senator. They couldn't disavow them anymore. And policies started to get created in response to the surveys. But the most striking thing about it was simply the victimization rate hitting people like a brick. Because although the victimization rate we had at my university was exactly like other universities, people don't believe it's in their own space. And seeing the local data was really profound. And even for me, when I walked into my class, my fall class, a room full of undergraduates, I almost started to cry. Because even though I'd been studying all this time, I looked around the room and it just really hit me that out of the 70 people there, I could count on a large number of them having been exposed to such horrific acts. But we learned a lot else from doing this. And we've now completed two big campus surveys and a number of other related surveys. And it's really actually taught me not only things from the data, but from the experience that I just described of how people respond to this sort of data. One thing I want to say is how we research these issues. It's important to know that we see sexual violence and harassment as a number of issues at once. So it's simultaneously a public health issue, criminal justice, spiritual, civic, educational, workplace, civil rights, and human rights issue. And it really is a mistake to get too focused on one of these to the exclusion of the others. So get too legalistic, too much about criminal stuff, you're losing a lot of what's actually going on. It's also both an interpersonal and institutional issue. Behaviors we measure under this umbrella, we measure sexual assault, contact sexual assault, stalking and dating violence, sexual harassment. And I want to say something about sexual harassment, which is everybody knows that sexual harassment includes sexual coercion. You know, if you sleep with me, I'll give you a promotion. Or if you don't sleep with me, I'll demote you. That's sexual coercion. Everybody knows it involves unwanted sexual attention that goes too far. What a lot of people don't realize is that the way researchers look at sexual harassment, it's as part of a spectrum that includes gender harassment that may not be obviously sexual in nature, but is gendered. So it's when people make comments that typically are derogatory regarding gender and behaviors. And so sometimes it's called, you know, come-ons and put-downs. And they're both part of sexual harassment. And as I mentioned, we use all behavioral items for these. On this issue of the continuum of sexual harassment, recently the National Academies of Sciences, Engineering, and Medicine did a beautiful study on, really, really well done, on sexual harassment in STEM. I really recommend the report that has been issued. It's all free and online. And they made available this graphic. And it's a way to sort of capture that certain kinds of sexual harassment are really visible to people in some sense, and others, and many more, are just sort of below the surface, but very much a part of the picture. This is, all of this is online. So I had a research team, as I always do. All the research I do depends on the work of other people, and I've tried to make everything open access as much as possible, all my survey instruments, as many of the results as I can. So one of the things that we found right away, and other researchers have seen this, is indeed this is a very gendered problem. If we look at victimization rates comparing male and female undergraduates, we see in every category of sexual violence we looked at higher rates for females. On the other hand, while that's true, it's that there's some non-trivial amount of male victimization that we're picking up as well. When we look at graduate students, it's probably going to be a little more relevant to your current context. What we see is, in some way, a similar pattern. Women are more risk, but in detail, a very different pattern of where that risk is greatest. And the next slide is going to take just female graduate students compared to female undergraduate students. And now the asterisks refer to the significance of a gender difference. What we see is undergraduates that are at much greater risk for contact sexual assault. There's only one category in which graduate students are at higher risk, but it's a really important category. And it's sexual harassment perpetrated by faculty or staff. And what we see is that 38% of our female graduate students are reporting some degree of this experience. And what's really alarming is that this is really bad for female graduate students. So we also looked at what you might call outcome variables. And I should hasten to add, this is correlational work. I cannot actually prove causality here. But these exposures are statistically associated with feeling unsafe, trauma symptoms, experiences of additional institutional betrayal after the event. And I've come to understand that sexual harassment by faculty and staff is itself kind of its own kind of institutional betrayal, to the extent the faculty and staff are representatives of the institution. So although it's not on our checklist, it's not the way we are measuring it, it probably arguably is a kind of institutional betrayal in addition to interpersonal betrayal. A note about sexual violence and sexual orientation: I measured inequality comes up, not just gender. When we look at sexual orientation, we have enough data to be able to do statistical analyses. We consistently see effects. So if we look at undergraduates, non-straight undergraduates are for females, the risk is not significantly different for straight or not straight, but for males, it almost doubles the rate of risk, and it's a statistically significant difference. If we look at institutional betrayal exposure, here we see the great risk for female non-straight students. These are people who have been victimized and then are trying to get help from the institution in some way. For graduate students, and I apologize, the order of items has been flipped here, but what we see is that our non-straight women have the greatest amount of sexual harassment by both peers and marching down to heterosexual men, and also from faculty and staff. So, you know, the idea that this sort of touches a little bit on is it about sex or power? Well, it's always probably about both, but this really emphasizes power. The inequality is a way The greater risk for inequality is indication that this is a way to keep people in their lower status place. So I think it's fair to say we've got intersections of dimensions of inequality that are happening in this, and that sexual harassment and assault is not just harming people in the sense of their well-being, but also contributing to a system of power that is ultimately not helpful. So I said I'd tell you something about disclosure. Disclosure is a topic I really get passionate about. It's really central to trauma because we don't talk about stigmatizing traumas. That's kind of the whole point. They're under the surface. They're not talked about. You may think you're in a room of people who haven't been traumatized, but I can almost guarantee that many people sitting in this room have been, even if they've never told anyone. Because traumas are often unspeakable, and there is often not room to talk about traumas. So it's very deeply connected. Furthermore, we know that there's a really fundamental practical problem here, which is without reporting, it's difficult to stop things like sexual violence, and yet reporting is extremely rare. In fact, only 6% of our sexually harassed graduate students have reported the harassment to university sources. In a separate study with a different sample, looking at undergraduates, we looked at 189 students who'd experienced sexual victimization. Only 50 had told anyone at all. Who did they tell? They told their friends. They told other students and friends, a few family members. They essentially told no one official at the university. So what's going on? Victims don't report for a very good reason. It's dangerous to report. It's super risky. And people know that. They know it's risky. And it is risky. And we know from empirical work that a bad response makes things worse. In a study of adult rape victims, and actually there's quite a number of studies pointing to this, if you look at how they're doing down the road, it's better predicted by the social response they got after the rape than by any detail of the rape itself. It really matters how people respond. And a bad response is, in essence, a kind of new betrayal trauma. Remember I said you can even have a natural disaster turn into a betrayal trauma by how the response goes. What are harmful responses? Well, probably it's pretty intuitive and obvious that they include things like blaming, invalidating, punishing. But maybe less intuitive is harmful responses can come even when people mean well but don't know what to do. So they can come from not acknowledging and changing the topic, minimizing reassurances, oh, that was so long ago, turning the discussion to the self, and importantly, taking away control from the survivor. I have an indication that a lot of this comes from people managing their own anxiety. It's really uncomfortable to hear somebody tell you about a terrible event. And in order to manage your own anxiety, you might engage in one of these behaviors. But they don't help. They can make things worse. We have done some studies in which we've tried to educate people about how to become better listeners. And we have results suggesting that when people have good intentions but are unskilled, they can learn to become better responders relatively quickly. And partly, I think we get these effects because people enter into this with a lot of ignorance. We don't tend to get taught how to be a good listener. I have discussion guides and tips online, and you are welcome to use them. A note about reporting policies. Institutions are scrambling all over the world to come up with good reporting policies. And there is often a desire and rush to mandatory reporting policies in which people absolutely have to tell if they hear about something, some sexual violation going on. I caution you that these policies might be counterproductive. That mandatory reporting has two problems. One, it takes control away from the survivor. It's their story, but they no longer control it. And that can cause psychological harm. In fact, if you look at the whole range of bad responses, including punishing and blaming responses, a number of studies suggest that taking away control is the most harmful thing you can do. Why? Probably in part because sexual violation involves taking away control in the first place. You've crossed somebody's boundaries. You've taken away their agency and autonomy. And even with the best intentions, if you do it again to them, the indication is you're likely to harm them. The other thing is, because people kind of know that intuitively, when they know there's mandatory reporting, they're less likely to report. It chills reporting. So it's counterproductive in that sense too. I like to think of this as a simple question of, is the policy safe and effective? Don't roll out policies until you know they're safe and effective. For some reason, higher education and similar institutions, as much as they might embrace empiricism, tend not to apply it to their own policies. There are alternatives there, and I have a resource page about alternatives. I want to mention briefly a particularly pernicious response. It's called DARVO, and it's a name I came up in based on observing things back in the 1990s. Recently, it's become a topic of research in my lab. DARVO is an acronym. It stands for deny the behavior, such as none of this ever took place, attack the individual doing the confronting, you're a disgusting human being. It can also involve attacks on their memory, on their sanity, and reversing the roles of victim and offender, and this is crucial. The person being accused assumes the victim role. I'm the victim here. These words and quotes come from one of the most famous people on the globe today. I bet you can figure out who said these words. The master of DARVO, who has way too much power right now. But you also probably saw it if you took any glimpse of the Kavanaugh hearings. It was very strongly a DARVO response. I don't think DARVO is well-intentioned. And I don't think it's going to be as easy to stop DARVO as teaching people some skills. But we do have some research to indicate that while DARVO seems to be effective, and it is effective both in two ways we've now measured, it tends to cause victims who've been DARVO to blame themselves, and it also reduces the credibility of when third parties are evaluating the credibility of victims, they are impacted by DARVO. The good news is that we have indication that if we teach people about DARVO, it reduces its power. So my advice is when you see it, call it out. Don't let it go unchallenged. Of course, when somebody's been accused of something they didn't do, they have every right to deny it. But DARVO is not a gentle denial. DARVO is an aggressive attack on the person who has often been brave enough to tell a truth that's difficult. All right, last section, institutional courage. So what to do about this big mess? I assume, actually, that most people mean well. Not everyone's well-intentioned, but I believe we have reason to believe the vast majority of people mean well. And the vast majority of people in institutions are trying to do what's right. And yet we see institutional betrayal crop up over and over. There's probably some emergent properties of institutions that are going on here. And in some sense, that makes it maybe an inevitable problem. But I don't think we have to stop there. Maybe it's inevitable that institutions will start to protect their reputation in a certain sense. But we can predict that. And if we predict it, we can put in countermeasures to try to mitigate against some of the bad sides of that. And that process I call institutional courage. Sometimes people often scold me about the words I use. The administrators have said, don't call it institutional betrayal. That hurts our feelings. And and courage is the wrong word. Isn't this about integrity? Well, yeah, of course it's about integrity. I could have called it a lot of things. But I'm going to stick with courage because I actually think it involves courage in the really profound sense that individuals are going to have to be courageous. And institutions as collectives are going to have to be courageous. This is hard stuff to address and change. It's going to take some bravery. But I think it will pay off. So I've come up with 10 steps that I think are where we can begin. And these are based on research to varying degrees. And I don't mean this is exhaustive. But I think this is pretty safe stuff to start with, and we'll have some good effects. One is to comply with laws. That seems like the laws that are designed to help prevent these things. That seems like a duh. But we see so much noncompliance all the time in the United States with the basic civil rights laws that are known as Title IX and Title VII. So compliance is a first step, but it is really important not to stop with compliance. Because if you get into a compliance mindset, it becomes a checkbox mindset. And people quickly game the system. They figure out how to say, yes, I've done this, without actually really doing it. So it's important to be always avoiding a risk management mindset and thinking about the spirit of the goal, not the letter of the law. Another equally important thing is education. There's a lot of really good research on trauma and sexual victimization and institutional behavior that people don't have access to, and they should, and they can. And it's by this, I do not mean sexual harassment training. I've gotten allergic to the word training. What we need is education, where people grapple with the concepts, have a deeper understanding, not be spoon-fed some rules about don't do this and do that. We need to respond well to victim disclosures, which of course involves educating people about how to do that, and create trauma-informed reporting policies. Institutions need to develop mechanisms where they can be accountable and bear witness to people's difficult situations and, importantly, apologize. And we see that sometimes happen. It can be extremely healing. It's also a place where it's essential to be authentic, because an insincere apology can be really harmful. One of the things I think is most important for institutions to figure out is, how do you cherish the truth tellers? We so often blame the messenger, when in fact the messenger is the best friend of an institution if they're only listened to. So how do we incentivize truth telling? Right now, people are afraid to tell the truth because they're afraid they're going to get retaliated against, that things will get worse. We need not only to have rules against retaliation, which are only minimally effective, in fact, we need to go the other direction and actually incentivize truth telling, making it something that people get some benefit for having done it. We've seen examples in limited ways of this occurring. The software industry will pay people to find bugs. We can figure out systems like that for these other issues as well. Conduct scientifically sound anonymous surveys and on a regular basis. I say scientifically sound here because people may have the idea that they can just make up a survey, but there's a whole art and science to how to measure these difficult things, and there are people that have figured out a lot about how to do this. And the anonymous is so important. I mean, you saw the reporting data. People really truly have to feel it is anonymous. So that means taking the time to have, off-site data collection, making sure it's secure. Regularly engage in self-study. So this is like focus groups, maybe a committee that's meeting all the time and saying, are we engaging in certain behaviors despite our best intentions? Being transparent about data and policy. Sexual violence thrives in secrecy. So does corruption. So does just about all the things that our problems with our institutions. They thrive in secrecy. And so it's important to you, as much as possible, while being respectful of people's privacy, to make other things as transparent as possible. The other thing I think is really important, and different organizations are going to have different access to this, but when possible, to use the organization not only to fix itself, but to outreach, to start to help society on a larger scale. So research universities should absolutely be supporting research and dissemination of this stuff. But other industries can do things too. It's starting to happen. The tech industry is starting to figure out ways to create technology to help on this problem. The film industry could make a huge difference. I really actually think the entertainment industry could change the world profoundly if it would, move from these sexually objectifying, ridiculous films to better ones. And there are some better ones out there. So, and then finally, this is not going to be free. It's not as expensive as some things, but it's not going to be free. So it's really important to commit resources to these things. I just love this quote from Joe Biden: don't tell me what you value, show me your budget, and I'll tell you what you value. Okay, I'm going to end with a story. And I find this inspirational. And it's a story about something that happened at Oregon State University. So I'm at the University of Oregon, which is in Eugene, Oregon. Oregon State University is in Corvallis, Oregon. They're about 45 miles apart. They're both really idyllic towns in the Pacific Northwest. But they're different schools. And so this is at Oregon State University. So in 1998, a young woman named Brenda Tracy reported to police that she'd been gang raped at a party. Two of the accused assailants were OSU football players. It was not handled well. The police and the prosecutors didn't take her case seriously. Her rape kit was destroyed. And the case never went to trial, or there were no arrests, nothing. The university didn't do much either. The two football players had one game suspensions and community service, and no one from the university even talked to Brenda Tracy. It wasn't good. And she went on to grapple with this all by herself. She suffered, but she did her best. She was a pretty strong person. She got a nursing degree. She moved forward, but she suffered a lot, too. In 2014, the discussion was all over the place about college sexual assault. And she got up the courage to call up OSU and say, hey, what happened? What happened to me in 1998? What happened to my case? Why did it disappear? At first, they kind of blew her off. But she happened to meet a columnist, a very popular columnist, sports columnist at the main newspaper in Oregon. And he was taken with her story and wrote a column. And I always imagine what the morning must have been like for the university president, the morning that came out, because he must have opened his email and it was flooded with copies of this story, I'm sure. But he didn't behave the way most university presidents seem to behave. Rather than get into PR mode and defensive posture and lawyer up, he ordered an investigation. And not only that, he made sure it happened pretty quickly. And 3 weeks later, he met with Brenda Tracy and shared the results of the investigation. Not only that, he apologized. And I want to read a little bit of his apology letter. He wrote, "Dear Brenda, Oregon State officials are very grateful that you took the time to meet with us. We're so sorry for what you experienced in 1998 and have lived with since. What we have learned recently of your suffering is heartbreaking, and your bravery inspires us. We're also grateful to you for raising the public dialogue about the consequences of sexual violence in our society and for raising a discussion of how society can better assist survivors of such violence. While we cannot undo this nightmare, we apologize to you for any failure on Oregon State University's part to better assist you in 1998. I've read this sentence and thought about it a lot. It's the key apology sentence here. And I know how universities in the United States work. There are lawyers all over that sentence. Probably lawyers told him, don't write the apology letter. Don't meet with her. But he was a good leader, and he said, I'm making this up, but I'm pretty sure it would have gone down like this. He said, thank you very much, legal counsel. I am going to do this. But I would also imagine he was willing to tailor his language to their advice as best he could. I think he threaded the needle here. It's a good sentence. It doesn't set the university up for too much exposure legally, but it also conveys a true apology. The letter went on. As promised a few weeks ago, we conducted an exhaustive review of the facts of how OSU handled this matter 16 years ago. This review is completed this past Friday, and we want you to share the results of that review with you. So transparency. It didn't end there. Ed Ray, the president, apologized, then he hired Brenda Tracy to be a consultant. And together, they made many innovations and changes on campus. To me, this is what institutional courage looks like. And it included investigation, transparency, apology, a partnership. They went on to actually lobby the state legislature, make some changes to state law, a lot of changes on campus. And you know, I've talked with Ed Ray quite a bit. I don't think he did this for a PR reason. I think he did this because it seemed the right thing to do. I forget his field, but it's a million miles from sexual violence. It was something technical. He didn't have a lot of knowledge about this. He responded at a pretty human level, but he showed leadership and he showed courage. And the end result was it was really good for PR. People like me talk about this story and campus lightened up. And people at OSU will say, yeah, there's still a lot of work to do there. Didn't fix everything, but it certainly made an important change in the right direction. So, you know, I think we can do this. We can nurture institutional courage. I do think ending sexual assault and harassment is a big challenge. For one thing, it requires going to dealing with families and children and how people are raised. It's going to take time and effort, but we can end institutional betrayal relatively quickly. In my own case, I'm kind of making a transition from being primarily working in a university to starting to work with organizations. I'm going to try to create a new center. And I always think of, I want my center to be as lovely as this one, with as idealistic a mission and as beautiful a building. And I just need to find my wonderful funder. I do think if we do this, it's going to be better for individuals, but also better for institutions, and it's a step in the right direction. So thank you very much.
Assault or sexual assault was going through a particular hard time in their life, in the sense of were they depressed or were they going through financial hardship or some mental instability, because I hear and I can imagine that as a perpetrator, you might think, well, if I do assault this person, she or he, I can just say they're going through, they're disturbed right now, or they're depressed and they're making it up.
Right.
So the point is, are those persons who are going through a particular difficult time in their lives, if they are potentially more exposed because they are less likely to be believed if they report an incident?
Yeah, that's a really insightful question. And yes, absolutely. There's the biggest insight we have to this is actually research with perpetrators and asking them how they pick their victims. And perpetrators indeed select victims that they think will be effective for them. So they will pick people that they believe, correctly or incorrectly, but they're often correct, who are more vulnerable. And this will include, as you said, people's current challenges and perhaps inability to be credible. It is very much a factor. The other thing, though, to know is, if somebody has like a thin skull and you punch them and damage their skull, it's no defense that their skull was thin, right? It's still harmful. And so somebody's underlying condition that might make them more vulnerable to harm is in no way a defense against that harm. But this other thing you mentioned, credibility, that's really tricky. And I think one of the things that's so important for education is if people can learn more about how victims respond and what it looks like, at least some of the credibility issues may not be as powerful.
You had this chart comparing undergrads to graduates, and you said everywhere except in one place, grads were lower. Have you parsed out who the perpetrators are? In other words, is this because there's more peer-to-peer thing with undergrads? Or is it like, why? Where is this coming from?
Yes. So yes and no. So in the way we've measured sexual harassment, we have been able to separate peer-to-peer from faculty staff. And it's only in the faculty staff that we're seeing graduate students at greater risk. When we look at peer-to-peer, there's not a statistically significant difference, but the trend is that actually undergraduates are getting more peer-to-peer harassment than graduate students. The unique risk for graduate students is faculty staff perpetrated. We don't know in detail, though, exactly who those faculty and staff members are. So we don't know, for instance, this is coming from primary advisors for students in the sciences. We do know that we've got some different rates for different kinds of academic fields. And so at my university, we don't have a med school or an engineering school, but we do have a law school. We'd have a business school and so on. We actually are seeing some of the highest rates in some of the professional schools. Our law school had extremely high rates, which is somewhat alarming when you consider who then goes on to wield power in society.
So just to clarify, so are undergrads at greater risk peer-to-peer than from faculty staff, or the same, or I didn't quite...
Oh, okay, so maybe it would help if I just went back to that chart, which I could do here. Here we go. This is the one you had in mind.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I mean, the peer-to-peer rates are overall obviously high. But in our analyses, we found that when we look at association with negative outcome, it's sexual or gender-based harassment by faculty and staff that is accounting for the vast majority of that association. We cannot, from this though, get at causality. And so, for instance, it's possible people who are suffering more from certain things are more vulnerable to harassment. In fact, they probably are, related to the question that was asked earlier. On the other hand, there's a lot of reasons to believe from a whole host of research that there is a causal effect primarily in the direction of harassment and suffering.
So I have two questions which I've been wondering about recently. One is the example you gave about leadership and how they should have a very good like an apology and all of these things they could do. I'm wondering, how do you take out the power distance between a victim and the leadership? Because it very much depends on the leadership, how they do this. And sometimes it can go the complete opposite way, which
right.
goes usually. So this is my one question. How do you make structures in an institution which takes away this power distance between the victim and the potential help she or he might go to? The second is, sorry, I forgot the second one. I'll talk about the next one.
Well, you know, that's a big project to take away power difference. And we live in a world that's very hierarchical, and power is reinforced by lots of factors. And I don't know how to dismantle the power structure, but I can say that sexual violence is playing a role in promoting that power structure. So if we can start to chip away at sexual violence, we'll probably somewhat, you know, reduce that. One of the things that is counter to the power of leadership to deny a problem is data. And so the anonymous, scientifically sound survey data really confronts aspects of leadership denial.
Yeah, I remember the next question. So let's say you order an investigation, as you said in your example, and in many cases it happens that the investigation does not have enough evidence or does not have enough strength to have either yes or no response. But in that case, the trauma is still there. Maybe the victim the victim could be either one. How, in that case, do you go ahead and make sure that the trauma is addressed, that still the victim feels that enough step has been taken and that they are in a secure place, and if the next time this happens, they can still go forward and talk to the institution?
Yeah.
So I'm wondering how in that case, how do you do it when you don't know what actually happened?
Yeah, which can be the case, and depending on what sort of standard of evidence is applied, you may, if it's what's called like a preponderance of evidence standard, you may find that the perpetrator is responsible. But if it's a, innocent until proven guilty standard, they may not. So I think really you're getting at a really difficult issue, which is how do we have good adjudication processes when somebody is saying something happens? And I have not seen any adjudication process that I can say for certainty is really a great one. I lean towards putting effort into prevention and creating a culture, a climate and culture that deals with the surrounding problem, because I actually don't know the answer to the adjudication problem. The most hope I have, though, is in an approach that's known as restorative justice, where individuals are, it's sort of like, I think, some of the concepts that might underlie some of the like truth and reconciliation kind of approaches, where people are encouraged to, as victims, figure out what it is they want to get out of the situation, and to move from a focus on punishment to a focus on make right. The sort of really retributive punishment-focused approaches to adjudication often are what's pushing people into saying there's not enough evidence, because the punishment raises the stakes. When if the outcome is not punishment but make things right, then people are often willing to accept responsibility in a way that they can't. So I don't know is, in some sense, the answer to your question. Another thing, though, to say is if we take an approach to the whole organization that's what some people would call trauma-informed, understanding that a lot of people have been exposed to these sorts of events in our workplace, in our educational context, and we're interacting with, we are some of these people, we may not be these people, but we're interacting with these people, it's all part of this society we're swimming in. If we sort of start with that assumption, then we create structures that are going to meet people's needs for help and growth and sanctuary, you know, when they've had these experiences, even if we can't agree on who was the responsible party.
Yeah, I guess I'm just wondering how do you give back power to a victim, even if punishment is not possible?
Yeah.
To the perpetrator.
Yeah. Yeah, well, you know, that's where we come back to controlling victim voice. So one way victims can have power is being in control of their story, getting to tell it when they want to, being activists in social movements. You know, there's various things like that.
First off, thank you for being willing to take this information and present it to more than just university students. This is a really amazing presentation. I have a couple questions. In the results part of your presentation, you talked about how you noticed this correlation where people kind of lower on the totem pole were the ones who were experiencing more sexual violence and harassment. And so I thought, while you were saying that, there's possibly some connection with it's people lower on the totem pole, not only because they're easier targets, but because when you experience that, it's harder to move up. So both those things,
right.
Would it be fair to say that both those phenomenons are happening?
Yes.
And then secondly, like, your presentation is mainly focused on sexual violence, but is it also fair to say that, like, this expands to bullying as well?
So we haven't done studies on bullying. So I don't have the data, but I would suspect it does. There is there's clearly lots of domains this concept could be applied. One domain that it has been applied is in healthcare in a non-sexual violence concept way. So actually, one of the lead researchers is a Canadian. She had been my doctoral student, and she's at the University of Regina, and she's done some really good work on institutional betrayal in healthcare. And in that case, what they're looking at is the response of doctors and hospitals and medical institutions to medical error. It's not the committing a medical error, it's the response to medical error. And they find that patient health goes down when you have more of that kind of institutional betrayal. I would assume we would see this with racial inequity, with financial fraud, a whole lot of domains where you've got institutional culpability that is going to harm people in this way, and bullying would seem. So, yeah, I can't do all the research on all the topics. I do want to go back to something that you said right at the beginning about it's two things going on for people who are lower on the totem pole. One is they're more likely to be targeted as victims, and the other is that once they are a victim, they're going to have a harder time being helped, believed, and so on. We do have data on that, because that's where we see greater rates of institutional betrayal for people who have less status, at least in terms of gender and sexual orientation. So I do think that is exactly right. There are two things going on there.
Cool. So then, what I was wondering about this concept can apply to other phenomena. Can you kind of take this approach of apologizing and you know, treating the victim with integrity and using that as a starting point? And you talked about your colleague. Is their solution method similar to yours?
Wait, say that again.
So for the other phenomenons where people feel institutional betrayal,
yeah,
is it fair to kind of have your 10 steps
applied?
What 9-step process?
Yeah.
Applied to that as well.
Maybe. Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of work that needs to happen to be able to say that with certainty. I tried to select actions that would seem to have relatively low risk, that even if they don't help in this particular way, are unlikely to lead people in a bad direction. So I can't see that there's a great potential for harm in applying these 10 steps, but whether they will be effective in the way I want really is going to take research. We are just launching a couple studies where we now have a measurement instrument for institutional courage, and we are going to be correlating with, and we're doing it in the workplace right now. We're going to look at employee responses, but then correlate it with certain metrics for organizations and start to try to get at some of that.
I was just wondering, so you mentioned institutional courage, and the prerogative is on the, presumably, on the part of the leadership at the institution to have this courage to handle things. And of course, preceding that was institutional betrayal. I was just wondering, how can institutions make themselves accountable, institutional accountability and institutional transparency? Those are two things that I was wondering about, because for example, in the case of Oregon State, how do they make sure that the procedures put in place involve representatives from every section of the student body, the admin people, everyone?
Yeah.
And how do they sort of also ensure that while you involve them, you're also accountable to them?
Yeah.
Does that happen? Because courage is good and fine, but the more important thing is, how do you put in place structures that make you accountable to the people who are parts of that institution, right? So there should be some mechanisms that hold you to account, whether or not you're doing what you say you're doing. So do you have any ideas on how institutions can make themselves accountable to people who are parts of those institutions?
Yeah. So I didn't go into detail on some of the steps, but in the self study part, one of the things I would encourage in detail is to really be intentional and deliberate about representation from all stakeholders. So it's not just leaders getting together and saying, is this stuff happening? But having representation from all levels of an organization meeting on a regular basis. To some extent, I think the answer to some of your question is actually almost like policy legislation, making a requirement that committees and groups that are working on certain things have a certain kind of representativeness from different stakeholders. Your question also, and something earlier that was asked, reminded me that one of the things, although I emphasize leadership, one of the things that people often do to change the world, no matter what their institutional power is to gain power through solidarity. So a group of student activists on my university had a lot of power when they worked together as a group. It really put the university under pressure to do something. I can promise you the university would not have been eager to make policy changes if there had not been student protests. It was the students who are the kind of lowest, or not, you know, among the lowest undergraduates. Another thing that I you know, was quite taken with, at the University of British Columbia, there have been a series of issues there and problems around sexual harassment of graduate students. And at one point, a group of 100 faculty members got together and wrote a letter essentially of apology on behalf of the university. It wasn't happening from central administration, so a group of faculty members got together and did it. And what a remarkable thing to do. Instead of saying, you senior leaders have to do it, they said, no, wait, we can do it. And although you know, it didn't solve all the problems, it was a really important step and very healing for the person who received the apology. I've collected apology examples, and one of the things that always strikes me when I talk to people who receive these apologies is how profoundly healing they are. One woman I worked with, she had 30 years of therapy for childhood sexual abuse. In her case, there was a botched criminal prosecution, and the perpetrator was her father. And she was suffering for 30 years. She got the idea of going back to the district attorney, the lawyer's office that was charged with prosecuting this, and told them how botched it was. And they investigated and wrote her an apology letter. And even though it's different people, but an apology letter on behalf of the institution. And she told me it was more effective than 30 years of therapy, one apology letter. And I think an important point about this is that we have a tendency when we get into the health mentality about this of pathologizing the individual who's been victimized. When really this is not about something wrong with the person, it's about something wrong happened to them. And so therapy can be less effective than apology because it's targeting what happened, not what's wrong with you.
Hi, I want to sneak you in. First of all, it's kind of a joke question, but are you actually measuring institutional betrayal or courage right now in the current context of the United States?
No.
Just curious.
I don't know if I need to measure.
I don't think you need to do.
Yeah.
No, my real question, though, is how we can reconcile possibly this propensity to focus on false reporting, which we know is really small, versus the issue of underreporting, and why that seems to be getting so much traction.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think we do a disservice to the whole issue when we get too focused on the problem of adjudication. It's such a bigger problem than that, and it gets really legalistic. I think all of us, you know, fairness, the desire for fairness is a very central value. Almost every political persuasion people have, religious orientation, fairness comes up as something people really care about. And I think it's actually part of the whole cheater detector thing, right? We want things to be fair. And so we want our processes to be fair, which means we don't want a process that's going to railroad people. We don't want a process where just an accusation alone has some dire consequence for somebody, because obviously an accusation can be false. So understanding that seems really important, but as you noted, getting completely hung up on that at the expense of this vastly bigger, statistically bigger problem is just leading us astray, which is why, if we're going to be focused on adjudication, I come back to something like restorative justice, where the point is not to punish people, but to get them to be accountable and make things right. And then there's going to be less of an obsession on this, I think.
Does your research show if appointing some sort of third-party ombudsman to help the adjudication process would be helpful, especially, say, in a smaller organization where it might be more difficult for people to report?
I don't have research on that. It's a great question, and having some experience with ombuds people, I would guess that a good ombuds person does make it much better for people. But yeah, we need research. Maybe they're like the Association of Ombuds People has done some research. I don't know, but yeah.
So you said something like secrecy is harmful to the process of seeking justice or closure. Well, I don't exactly remember that. So sometimes it happens that the victim is going through the process of the institution, and they are not happy with us in the process. Sometimes they are told that if they want to complain about it, they are told that they cannot because it has to be a confidential process. Mm-hmm. Although the victim is probably not talking about the investigation itself, but the process, like the investigation of the crime, is different from the crime itself, right?
Right.
So what's your opinion about that? Is that something that should be encouraged to that the victim or alleged victim should not talk about it, or that they should be heard?
Yeah. Well, I always worry when people are told they're not supposed to talk about their experience, and that raises red flags. I do think that this is sometimes a tricky, nuanced set of issues. On the one hand, we want to respect people's privacy. On the other hand, we want transparency for process. And getting it right is really, really important. And a lot of times, institutions will claim that they're protecting privacy when really they're covering up. So it's really good to be interrogating what the real issues are, and being really clear that there are these two values that we need to get right for both of them. If a victim is being silenced, I would be worried, because that suggests, you know, that there's something maybe amiss. Sometimes, though, investigations probably do need to be quiet. Sometimes there's a good reason for that, I'm sure. So I don't think it's as simple as, like, you can just have a simple rule here. But I would, I think we'd gain some ground by raising the conversation to talk about these principles and values and asking for an explanation that's really clear. If you're telling somebody that you can't tell them what's going on, that your explanation is really fitting with what, say, the victim and other people are saying.
Sorry, can I ask another question? What do you think of the fact that sometimes these investigations, although the results are conveyed to the victim, the report itself is kept secret from the victim?
Yeah. Well, yeah, again, it's another one where I don't know if I could make any blanket statements, because there may be sometimes legitimate reasons for that. Maybe there's information in the report that's exposing somebody else. So there might be. But again, I'd be concerned. You know, I would be concerned, and I'd be suspicious if there's a pattern here of hiding information. But I can't say in a general way it's always the wrong thing. Yeah.
Okay, so I close officially the seminar. Thanks for showing up with these numbers. If it's near to your heart, I remind you that we have actually two logins. Platform on sexual harassment policy and communication. And if you are interested in that, contact my dev or myself. They're already established, but thank you for more people. Yeah. And thanks for coming.
Thank you. Thanks for listening.